Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Pro Photography Podcast. It is May 30th, 2024, and, you know, things are getting crazy, not just with the cameras and the AI, but just with, like, the world around us and how to be a professional photographer and stand out and make it is harder than ever.
Welcome to the New Web Pro Photography Podcast, where we talk about what's new, what's old, and what works for professional and enthusiast photographers. Find show notes, videos, and more at simfx.com/podcast.
All right, folks. It's good to be back here on episode 210 of the Pro Photography Podcast. First of all, I apologize for taking so long to get the next show out. This year has been blowing by me. I didn't even realize it had been this long. Now, I don't do a Pro Photo podcast every week, but you guys can, of course, follow me on my YouTube channel over at youtube.com/SimeStudios. And I try to do a video like every week, like on these kind of isolated breakout topics. But I've been trying to do a podcast every month, and I haven't done great at that this year. But Pro Photography Podcast is alive and well. We have lots to talk about. And these shows are a little longer and covering a bit more in-depth topics. And I apologize for taking so long, but today we're back and we do have, you know, on the last episode, we talked about how good should our photos be. I touched briefly on things like pictorialism and AI just kind of honestly kind of ruining everything. And I know we keep coming back to this, but it's really all that photography is talking about right now, because it's kind of taking away what photography is for a lot of people. Now, that doesn't mean there's not good things from it, right? We're going to come back to that on today's topic. And actually, one of the things I've been working on for the past couple of months, and one of the reasons I've been so busy, is I took that pictorialism concept and I made a really crazy pack, powerful pack of Photoshop actions, one of my new products called Pictorialist, that actually just released a couple weeks ago. And that's why I now have some time to kind of get on here and do the show. But you can check that out. I'll mention that, you know, maybe as we talk about some topics on today's shows. But the idea of that is it's really a toolkit to help you make pictorialists and pictorial photos. And I think that's important, but it's not important that you use my tools to do it. I think what's important is the principle that it teaches us. And we'll come back to that a little bit on today's main topic, which is photos should have feeling. And we're going to come back to that and explore that from a couple of different aspects. But first, I want to talk about news. By the way, you can find show notes, links, some of these topics I've been talking about. People have been posting photos of their own pictorials and our discussions over on the Shadow Hunters group on Facebook, the Photography Shadow Hunters group. You can actually just search it, but I'll also link it in the show notes over at simeffects.com, simeffects.com/podcast. And you can find everything over there. Let's get started, though, because there's a few things I noted. I'm always kind of keeping an eye on photo news, and there's some really good sites like Petapixel, and a lot of times I follow them because they summarize a lot of what's going on out there. But this actually popped up in a couple places, this article from this report on ASMP, which is the American Society of Media Photographers. And they published this scathing rebuke of Adobe, basically because Adobe's coming out. And they're saying that Adobe is making a shocking dismissal of photography and photographers who have dedicated their lives to creating it by basically making the selling point all about fakery and AI. They actually used the tagline, skip the photo shoot. Skip the photo shoot. Well, why not just skip the photographer, Adobe? Now, it's interesting because it's called Photoshop. Now, I realize people use Photoshop for illustration of all kinds, right? And that's fine. But Adobe is a company that generates massive revenue off subscriptions. They made their company on photographers and photographers using their product. And ASMP just said Adobe should take a hard look at how it describes photography and photographers and determine if you support this industry or wish to aid in its destruction. Now, we're at a turning point. We've talked about this a lot on the show here that, yeah, we're, this is a turning point in photography, in media in general. I would say from what I'm seeing, and if you guys, a lot's been happening in the past couple months. And if you guys have been watching things like the eclipse, for example, an eclipse happened since the last show. I didn't go out and hunt photos of the eclipse. What's the point? The real photos of the eclipse did not get any attention. Now, I know I'm exaggerating a little. Let's think positively here. It was really cool. And I saw it down here in Central Mexico. You know, I played with it, looked at it with the kids and took a few photos, but nothing that I even bothered sharing, right? It wasn't like I had a plan. I went out to some amazing place or anything like that. Northern Lights up in the north didn't make it down here, but that just happened. Same kind of thing. One of my first photos was actually that got published and recognized was actually of the Northern Lights. And so this kind of goes back to all of this AI stuff. And I remember it was hard to get. It took a lot of tone control, and they're not near as bright as they look in photos. It was one of my early digital photos that actually got printed. I think it was a 6 megapixel, like 10D or something like that I shot that on. And I remember it got displayed large at some kind of an exhibition. And I worked hard for that photo. And when I saw these photos of all these Northern Lights coming out, the eclipse photos were so obviously faked, right? The sun eclipsing was setting into the ocean. And I'm like, wait a minute. But I was watching it, and it was up there, and where this photo is taken of, where it was visible from, it wouldn't have been setting. And you saw these photos. I've even posted them on the SimFX page and discussed them a little bit. I mentioned them in some of my recent YouTube videos because it's absolute fakery. Almost none of the photos you saw going viral on Facebook of the eclipse were real. Right. It's the same with these pages. These pages call themselves National Geographic and they post an eclipse and people that are, I'm literally seeing friends share this photo, like, look at this photo of the eclipse from National Geographic. And I'm thinking, guys, did you actually stop to think at all that maybe the burning sun eclipsing while dropping into the ocean and radiating these octopus like ribbons of light? Like, what? We've never seen this in our lives, right? AI came and the universe just started to change nature. It's the same with how crazy and intense a lot of these so-called Northern Lights photos were. Now, there were some beautiful photos. The problem is you don't even know what's real anymore. It was a little because some of them were so obviously fake. But those are the ones going viral because a lot of people really don't grasp what AI is doing, how fake it is. And so what's happening, and you guys know this, and it kind of creates this toxic backlash. And I'm still on this ASMP, this Adobe topic here. I just want to throw a couple of these subnotes in there because I think you guys are seeing the same thing. And you can leave a comment in the show notes. You can go to the Shadow Hunters page. We can talk about this and you can say what you think on this and let me know your thoughts. Am I exaggerating or is this for real? Because I want to hear from you guys on this. As a photographer for what, nearly 25 years now, I've seen all these changes. I started on film. But nothing has changed and actually taken away photography itself. Yes, when digital came, we all said, okay, everyone's a photographer now. That's still true, right? And the phones even do amazing photos now. You could give me a phone and I could shoot a wedding just fine on it. I wouldn't because my, quote, real camera is going to do a lot better job. But understanding light and shadow hacking and all that kind of stuff, like I always talk about on the Shadow Hackers Workshop, on this show, on my YouTube channel, that's what makes a photographer, not the camera itself. But we're seeing all these photos now that weren't made with cameras at all, right? Most of these photos, and I mean, starting to even see mainstream YouTubers talk about it. I watched a video the other day, and it was like, it was a skit. I'll try and link it. Of somebody logging into YouTube after years and Facebook, not YouTube. He logs into Facebook and he's like, oh, I just decided to check in. Like, what's up here? It's like, oh, well, here's a photo of a cozy cabin. And he says to Facebook, did I follow a page called Cozy Cabins? And Facebook says, oh, no, but we don't care. That's not how Facebook works anymore. And I'm sitting there nodding my head because nothing you see on Facebook anymore is from your friends most of the time or of the pages you followed, right? It doesn't matter anymore. You guys remember when we first set up Facebook pages for our business and things like that, like people followed us because they wanted to follow us, and you'd post a photo and it would encourage you, hundreds of likes and comments. I mean, I remember posting photos on the SimFX page in the early days. I would get hundreds of likes in like 15 minutes. Now I can post a photo that I've worked really hard on. It'll get 3 or 4 likes in a week. And I'm like, wait a minute. No, I know what I'm doing. This is a good photo. And I know you guys are doing the same. I have like 60,000 likes on the SimFX page, right? Those numbers mean nothing anymore. It's all algorithms. And he's in this skit, he's looking at this photo and he says, but is that AI? And Facebook's like, no, that's not AI. He's like, but there's like a stove on the ceiling and the dog has a tail on both ends. There's no head. No, it's not AI. And this skit goes on, and I'll actually link this skit because it really speaks to what's going on right now. The reality is, these social media sites don't care. They're rewarding essentially these spam pages. And sometimes they're doing this with national news, war news, like things that are very serious, right? And you'll see these photos and they're just to get likes and engagement. And so then what happens is you see these, and those of us that know get on there and say, this is AI nonsense, right? You have these pages like world-class landscape photographers. Most of the photos getting attention on there now are simply not photos. They're absolutely fake. And so people jump on and they say, this is fake. And other people say, well, stop being negative. What does it matter? It matters because it's a lie. It doesn't matter. What's bad is not that you used AI to illustrate something or that you painted something. What matters is that you're pretending something's real. That's not, because these pages aren't publishing these things as saying, like, you know, here's artwork of the eclipse, right? But it's not real. It's just a painting. It's just an AI painting. It's not what they're doing. They're doing the absolute pushing the limits of the technology to make it as much like a photo as possible so that most people believe it. And so then people are fighting and being toxic with each other about why it matters. Well, it does matter because it's a lie, okay? But what happens is these spammers who ultimately are making money, whether it's by hacking accounts, whether it's by getting money from Facebook because their page has a lot of traffic, they're making a profit of creating these images that are ultimately just images generated from models that were created from decades of other photographers creating photos, and it's making its own rendition of those in a more sometimes perfect, flawless way, and sometimes with three arms. But the point being is it's fake. It's a lie. And there's very little way to do it. Now, let's continue with this, though, because first Adobe's called out for basically throwing photographers under the bus, right? But then you're starting to see small efforts being made to tell people when it's AI. Okay, this seems good. We've talked about, content. Well, I mentioned this on the website recently. Content creation. Content credentials. I mentioned some months back on the show where it's essentially a little icon and you can click it and it shows the path that that photo has been from. I've started saying on like pages, and I'll flat tell people when they post, hey, photos, these over-the-toply beautiful, over-the-toply, is that a word? These over-the-top perfect landscapes, for example. And I said, you know what? Post a screenshot of the raw photo, or I don't believe you. This is a fraud. You're lying. And I'll just say it. Like, I'm trying not to be toxic. I don't really want to fight, but I want to know what's real and what's not, right? So you have things like content credentials, but major social media platforms haven't adopted this yet, really. So you have like Instagram that's starting to adopt stuff, but companies like this, they always want to create their own versions of technology that they control, that they can ultimately make money on, and that are non-accountable, right? And they're just like the way that random posts are deleted off Facebook when it makes no sense. Your speech, your voice is essentially being controlled by an AI now on these major platforms. There's not real people reviewing this. Now, there was this photo, and I'll link to this article on Petapixel carrying on from this. And I apologize if all the news is about AI, but it's like, you know, it's like when we switched from film to digital. Everyone was talking about digital and what it's going to do for us. Eric Pardee posted a photograph, and absolutely, it looks like AI. If I saw this on a page, I would think it was AI, right? But he then showed behind the scenes. He showed him setting it up. It's as if a model backlit on the salt flats with like this spinning light behind it. it's really cool knowing that this is actually a photograph because it 100% looks like AI generated. And so what's the difference? Like, well, wait a minute. If we're trying to make photos that look like AI generated, no, we're going to come to that in our main topic. Feeling and the story behind something matters. And I think you guys are actually, I think we're on the same page. I think we agree with this. If you're a photographer, you already know this. But what happened is it got labeled AI because of either how he edited it, maybe he used the AI retouching brush in Photoshop or something like that. And yes, maybe it's just because it's kind of an otherworldly images that is the kind of thing that would be accused of being AI. And so he did, he's doing the right thing, right? He shows behind the scenes and what he's doing. And as photographers, people say, well, like, if I made a photo and it's real, like, I don't have to prove anything. Well, yeah, you do. Because in a world where virtually everything that's going viral is fake, if you want people to take you seriously, I will leave photos now in groups. And if they're really distinct, like landscape, star trail, stuff like that, I'll post the original. I'll post the metadata with it. I will say, like, here's the original, just to let people know, like, I actually care about proving this is real. I'm not a poser. And I'll leave the first comment on the photo I post with validation that it's real. Because we don't have anything integrated into these systems to actually validate that. And so there's a couple articles that kind of span out from this on Petapixel, basically saying that on the one hand, the internet's full of AI photos, and then somebody posts a real one, and Facebook, Instagram, they now punish people and sabotage them with nonsense. And somehow, Petapixel's been doing some tests where, you know, if you take out a spot or a trash can and you use the AI brush in Photoshop, it knows. Now, is Photoshop putting some kind of a tag in there so it knows, or what? Well, we should know, right? Another news story is that AI generative fill has come to Lightroom. Right. And so you're seeing these videos, you've probably seen some of these videos pop up on YouTube. And I'm like, just what we need is more AI garbage. Right. Don't get me wrong. AI selections and things like that we've had in Lightroom for a couple of years. Some of you that listen to the show probably use my Elegance brushes. And I've been able to do these amazing speed combo masks where one is the subject, one is the background, one is the eyes. And it's basically these retouching combos that I've built into presets that are very powerful. You can apply to one and then you say, hey, I like this. And you can copy that to your whole session. And I don't have to manually do that and adjust those settings and adjust brushes. I built that into these what I call speed mask presets. And you can make your own of this, right? You dial in, you build a mask of like 12 presets in Lightroom. And we can now do this a little bit. I've even released my Elegance brushes for Capture One now, because this year's Capture One has some AI subject selection. Even though it's not as advanced as Lightroom, they're starting to catch up a bit. And so I actually released my Elegance speed masks for Capture One as well. And these are really powerful tools. But when we talk about that kind of AI, it's assistive AI. It's not making my photo. It's helping me make selections so that I can then say, okay, apply these sliders to that selection. I can get softer skin. I can balance the shadows in the background and key off my subject a little more and create that sense of depth. And so if you guys have watched my videos on the channel about using speed masks, and or if you've made your own, where you've made these mask combos and saved them, you know the power of that. But now we're getting AI generative fill, not to the extent of Photoshop where you can just build it from scratch, right? But it's AI generative remove, for example. You know, you can remove the light stand, you can remove a tree, you can remove a person. And so now we're getting to this crossover where it's like, okay, I used an AI tool, but the photo is real. Now it's getting tagged as AI versus the people that know how to game the system are making a completely AI image that's completely fake. And it's getting receiving attention as if they went out and did the work and made a real photo. That's not okay. That said, I don't actually, when I saw AI generative fill coming to Lightroom, I cringed. I was like, just what we need is more AI. More fakery. And I don't know, maybe I'm being a little too negative, right? Technology's growing, things change, and we have to adapt with it. But more and more, all this generative fill stuff came to Photoshop. I'm not using it. If I go out and make a photo and do a portrait session, there's nothing that this is going to do that I can't do with a healing brush and a clone stamp. And I know even some of the healing brush and patch tools now are doing AI stuff, okay? where do you draw that line? I want to take a photo so it's correct. I get that sometimes you need to remove dust spots, maybe even a trash can, a piece of litter, something like that. But you know what? When I'm out shooting a portrait or landscape, if at all possible, I'm like, oh, there's a piece of litter. I try to actually pay attention in camera and I go pick up the piece of litter, right? I don't want that. I want the real natural scene without the litter. I don't just want to leave the litter there. I know that's not always possible. But if I'm doing a portrait, I actually pay attention. Oh, there's a foam cup on the ground, right? But we've gotten, I think, so used to being lazy and that everything's fixed for us in post that we don't even care. And we just leave it. And I say, let's not just leave it. Go pick up the cup and take it with you to a trash can. Does that kill us? These are just thoughts when I see all the fakery. I know photos have been being retouched since long before Photoshop. I know when Photoshop came out, it got a lot easier. And over the years, it's gotten more and more easier to make fakery seem real. And at some point, fakery, what we call fakery, is also illustration. The key is whether you're being honest, right? I see all these photos of, like, even before AI generation, these massively pasted in moons where I'm like, I actually commented on one of these recently. I think the whole thing was AI generated, but at the very least, the moon was put in. And I said, it's like, oh, look at this amazing sunset with the moon in Arizona. And I'm like, that's not a photo of a sunset of the moon. The moon never looks like that. It's never that huge in this context. And the response is you know how that works on the Facebook. It's probably not even worth commenting because it just gives more attention to those photos. That's the other problem. And people are saying, oh, you've clearly never been to Arizona. I've been to Arizona tons of times. I've taken lots of photos in Arizona. Like the moon, I've been a photographer for 20 plus years. The moon is not going to look like that behind the hills in Arizona, ever. You know the kind of photo I'm talking about. Let's move on from AI for a little bit. And let's just talk about taking photos, right? And this brings... I saw this article, and this is sad. I sometimes want to leave these kind of articles out because this will probably be our last news story of the day, so we can go into main topic. I sometimes want to leave these out because it's just not happy. But I think it's important as photographers that we're very self-aware of the work we're doing. Apparently, this happened this is an article on Petapixel, but this happened in Guadalajara, Zacualco de Torres in Guadalajara, Mexico. And I've been to Guadalajara. I know the area. And it says that apparently a model from Venezuela died after her clothes got tangled in a train going by on a photo shoot near the tracks. And apparently the train hooked onto her clothes and it dragged her in. And this is really sad. I don't like people hurting. But I thought we should bring this up because I see so many of these train track discussions. Well, this photographer was an idiot. You should never photograph on the train tracks. I see all this time. If you post a photo on Facebook and there's train tracks, heaven forbid the model's on the train tracks, people are going off, right? Like, that's illegal. You can't do that. And first of all, it's not. It's actually completely normal. If you go to the train, if you drive down to the area where there's shade and the trees are on a Sunday afternoon in San Juan del Rio, a town near me in Mexico, literally everybody's hanging on the train tracks, playing on the train tracks. All the parents are there. They're having barbecues. Like, it's a place where people go to hang out because there's trees. There's not a lot of trains going through. And the interesting thing about this story is this person didn't die because they were on the train tracks. So the problem with this, everybody always wants to talk about accidents involving trains, right? But how many news stories would there be if we talked about accidents of people walking in the road, right? There's pedestrian accidents with cars. There's so many ways that we can leave this mortal part of the universe. But trains make sensational stories. And people say, well, you know, it's illegal to be on the train tracks. That's trespassing. The train companies have managed to make lots of rules in the U.S., but those do not apply worldwide. No train police exists to come harass you in Mexico if you're walking on the train tracks. It's not illegal. It's just people doing their thing. Now, then photographers, what bothers me, and I think what we need to recognize, is the way we tend to respond to these stories is by pointing the finger at someone. Social media turns people into a very rapid sort of mob of accusation. I don't know the whole story of what happened here. I can link this article if you want to look into it. It's just a very sad story. They weren't actually trying to avoid the train. The train was supposed to be going by in the background. I'm assuming kind of a blur, and there must have been a large dress or something that was blowing. The concept actually sounds very cool, and it went horribly wrong. There's been lots of photos taken non-train related where similar things happened throughout history. So rather than point blame, I think we need to learn to be very careful with our clients, our models, our subjects, our friends, ourselves. I myself have almost fallen off a cliff before in national parks by being too busy talking about my camera while backing up and not paying enough attention to my surroundings. And thankful to the person who said, "Hey, whoa, stop," right? Because I was so distracted. I never did that again. I learned a lesson from that my gossip about cameras and about what I'm doing and about how cool they are, whatever, is not more important than my life. But what I think is important is we don't get to decide what a good photo is. And I don't think we should have sections of photography and artisticness that are demonized. Sometimes a photo of the person on the railroad tracks is very good. Right. And people say, why would you need that on the railroad tracks? It's so cliche. It's a good leading line. And railroad tracks go through a lot of amazing places. It's that simple. Now, if you don't like to do that, don't do it. And a lot of times it is cliche. But what I think the takeaway from this is, as photographers, as human beings, we tend to see a bad news story. And it's like, let's just beat up and let's point fingers. And I think what we need to learn is it's not about railroad tracks. If we're out taking photos, whether it's a family, whether it's a model, a senior portrait, I talked about in a recent video of when we edit, we shouldn't show people, our clients should never be culling for us. They should never see the rejects. This was last week's video on the channel. We've built rapport. We should be confident. We should know what we're doing, and they should trust us. They're also trusting us when we're in charge of the shoot and we're out there. And I don't care if you're taking a photo hiking into the wilderness, if you're in the middle of a road in the city doing an urban shoot, if you're near a train track, things can go wrong. And as photographers, what we need to do is be very self-aware, right? We're out hunting shadow, trying to make beautiful photos, but we need to be very self-aware because they're trusting us. And I think that's what should be learned from this. And also, we shouldn't get stuck in our own cultural bubbles of like, oh, that's illegal, that's illegal. You wouldn't believe how many times I've seen that. And I'm like, just because where you live, there's rules about this, doesn't make it illegal. And by the way, you having your model stand in the middle of the road while the sun is setting and doing a photo is probably just as dangerous. Be careful, please. I hate seeing stories like this, and I'm sure you guys do too. And I just felt like we should bring that one up. And you guys can leave your comments. I know a lot of people disagree with me on this. Like, you should never be on the railroad tracks. I've seen this topic discussed for 20 years. And I feel like it's just a scapegoat conversation to avoid talking about how we really need to be professional and responsible and competent and aware of our surroundings in every situation. But I think that's enough for news today, because I could probably go all day on various news stories. And these were some interesting topics. What do you guys think? Let me know in the comments. All right, let's get into our main topic for the day, and that is that photography should be felt. This became the theme, actually, for the recent pictorialist actions that I worked on. And if you do nothing else, go to simfx.com/pictorialist. I'll link it in the show notes as well. And just watch the intro video that I made about why I made these actions and what I do with them. That's all. Even if they're not for you, you're going to go make your own. You're going to do your own thing. That's fine. But watch the video I made, because I think I tried to sum up in that video why I think the concept of pictorialism. And what do I say when I mean pictorialism? Pictorialism was the early 1900s in photography. And it was the photographers that were saying, no, we inherited this profession from the painters. we need to do creative things. It was kind of them against the purest photographers that know that photography should just be used to capture what is, right? And so you've all seen kind of those early portraits of people like strapped into like head clamps and stuff like that to hold them still and get this, their exact likeness, staring straight at the camera, that very early kind of photography where everything was just supposed to be natural. Pictorialism was editing creativity in Photoshop 80 years before Photoshop. And so, you know, you have people like Stieglitz, Hendry Peach Robinson, they would stack negatives sometimes. They would use textures or grittiness in the way that they process. They would have a rougher process. You have people like Leonard Misson, and they would do ways of creating contrast and papers and things like that to make it almost like they were pencil drawings, and yet you could still tell they were photos. If you go look up some of these, they're really beautiful. And just, I'll show some of these in the videos. In fact, on the Pictorialist page, I've been making a few videos just about pictorialism in general for the past month. And I'll just link a few of those if you want to check them out, because these videos I've been making will apply even if you don't use any of my tools. In particular, I did a pictorialism webinar about a week ago and just talked about the concepts of how you build pictorialism digitally to get these effects. But the ultimate idea here is you're creating these creative effects where the being the sharpest, being the most detailed, being the most natural isn't the primary goal. You look at famous portrait photographers, later pictorialists, but they were still doing pictorialist techniques. Orton effect is a pictorialism technique where he would stack positives, right, slides. And one is blurry. Most of us have done the Orton effect or use an Orton effect action or something like that in Photoshop at some point. And, you know, you'd have one overexposed blurry slide mixed with one normal. And, you know, you get these kind of glowy, beautiful things that now we can do pretty easy in Photoshop. I shouldn't say pretty easy, because it was actually a huge amount of work to try and get an authentic pictorialist feel in Photoshop. Over the past few months, I've really been just grinding, figuring out the right way to combine these layers. And I'll show you how to do that a little bit in the Pictorialist webinar workshop. It's about an hour long video on how I make pictorialism, but also how I discover new looks and find things in terms of layer blends and things like that. You had David Hamilton. People said he put Vaseline on his lens. I don't know what he did, but he has these always these beautiful, glowing kind of portraits. And they're usually these models in these pastoral kind of scenes, homes, yards, things like that. And most of them are at least partially unclothed. But what he was famous for was this kind of soft, warm, glowing, iconic style. And so I worked really hard to kind of recreate that. And that was probably one of the hardest ones to do, was to get that David Hamilton look into the new actions I was working at. It was actually the main thing that inspired the whole concept for making a pictorialism effects kit, right? But what I'm getting at, you can do this however you want. You could do pictorialism in the darkroom. You can stack your layers and mix blending modes and blurs and all this kind of stuff. What you can't do very much is do it in Lightroom. Now, pictorialism starts in the camera. Don't get me wrong. Pictorialism, some people look at pictorialism and it's like, oh, I can take my blurry photos now and they're art. Well, what I'm actually finding is I am going back to a lot of photos that were rejects. This is why I rarely delete rejects from years ago. And I'm getting some really beautiful stuff by taking the pictorialist approach. But our mindset ever in photography, especially in this AI age where it's so easy to make perfection from fakery, I don't think our mindset should ever be like, oh, I can just be lazy and I'll fix it later. That's absolutely not what I'm getting at with pictorialism. In fact, in studying pictorialism over the past few months, I've started shooting, right, my environmental type portraits and things like that. The way people move through the frame, my shutter speeds even being a little bit slower, maybe trying to get some natural blurs and then mix those with a pictorialist like edit. It's actually got me some really interesting things. And I cover that in the pictorialist class that I did the other day as well. They'll link in the show notes. But study this. Go look up the pictorialist from the early days, the early 1900s, even into like the 80s and 90s. And I think there's something to be learned from pictorialism. And I mentioned this, I think, on the last episode, but I've gone way deeper into it over the past couple months, because we have these lenses now. They're so sterile and sharp. It's so easy to get a sharp lens now. We have AI. We have all these tools. We have tools that even if the photos are blurry, they use AI to make them sharp. But you know what we don't have in a lot of photos is feeling. And what I realized in studying pictorialism is that photos should have feeling. They should have a soul. Whatever you're taking a photo for, whatever you feel there in your heart, you're trying to convey that. And when you see all these AI photos, they're so perfect. They're so beautiful. The models in the AI photos are flawless. There's not a mark on them. They have perfect shape. The landscapes are absolutely pristine and otherworldly, like out of a fantasy. But you know what they don't have is feeling. Fakery doesn't have feeling. This is actually true. Even the more you use a clone tool a lot of times, even if you're not using AI, the more you fake, just like when you paste stuff into a photo, you paste your sketch. When you go out and you take a sunset, a landscape, and then you go to Affinity or Photoshop or something, and you paste in a fake sky, do you feel? Does it feel good? It doesn't to me. That's why I never paste in fake skies. I'll burn and dodge skies. I'll use AI masking on skies. You know, I'll do maybe some paint on some color overlays to give my vision a road to travel. But I almost never do composite images. Now, again, if you do composite images, I don't think that's bad as long as you're honest. I think where the soul of an image is lost is in a lie. Our soul is lost in a lie. As people and as artists. Can I say that? Because if you say, hey, I did this beautiful composite photo. Look at this. I'm like, wow, that's really cool, right? If you're honest, I look at it completely differently. Then it could have feeling because your intent was honest and genuine and you're making art, just like if you were painting something. I suppose the same could be true of AI, but I feel like AI is kind of low effort generally because I've experimented with AI myself. And you can get these amazing scenes, but I don't feel. After the, you know, and there's this initial excitement of, wow, this is super cool technology. But what I realized, and I mentioned this on some of the recent shows, that I actually dug in and learned AI and the models and all this kind of stuff and figured out how it worked. It didn't excite me because there was no effort. There was no soul. None of my soul was being poured into it. It was just being generated. It didn't have any feeling to me. The way we project ourselves, how we feel about an image should go into it. And it will. If you put your heart and soul into an image, and you learn and you've practiced and you've trained, right? It has the feeling that you intended. And that's what's important. When I say photos should have feeling, photography should be felt. What I mean is there's a magic to that that I think goes beyond a camera pressing a button or Photoshop or film or any of it. Because I think it goes into, not to be all mystical, but I think it actually at some point goes into the energy of our soul, if you will. I'm not trying to turn this into a church sermon, but the energy of our own feelings and thoughts and how we convey those and how those affect other people around us. Is that too weird for a pro photography show? I think the best photos have feeling. And so I don't think the only way to do that is pictorialism, but as a street photographer, as a portrait photographer, as a landscape photographer who kind of goes between these different genres and focuses on them at different times, I love exploring. I love challenging myself. But the photos that I feel, and then there's sometimes photos that I feel, but technically the photo's not quite there, right? I might have felt a certain thing taking that photo, but then I realize it's not quite coming through. That's kind of what I love about pictorialism, is you can draw attention to the emotions in a photo because there's so much things like, you know, you're blurring certain areas, you're using a lot of shadow. Look at some of the examples in my pictorialism workshop on the channel that I'll link in the show notes and you'll kind of see what I mean. Or go research pictorialism yourself and you'll see what I mean. It creates this kind of emotional feeling in a photo. You don't have to take a pictorialism kind of approach. Pictorialist photos are generally a bit softer. They're not trying to be super sharp, super pristine. You can have feeling in a razor sharp landscape, but sometimes I do feel like perfection becomes sterile. Perfection becomes sterile in our photography. Not always, of course. I know it's a little bit of a generalization, but I, as someone who for many, many years has made large wall portraits and really watched the cameras grow from 6 megapixels to 20 to 40 and actually really enjoyed that because I'd studied wall portraits. I understand how to make environmental portraits. I worked with Ken Whitmire and was doing these big canvases of people and families and landscapes and all this stuff. And so I love a detailed image. But detailed images can still be applied with this concept of pictorialism. I can have a super detailed image, but then I process it in a way that actually darkens and reduces that detail in certain ways to draw attention and focus to where I want it. Because remember, all great photos have one subject. This is very often forgotten. There has to be one focal point. This is something we talk about in my Shadow Hackers workshops. If you've never been to one of my free live Shadow Hackers class, definitely go to simfx.com, and there's a link right at the top for Shadow Hackers. And you can sign up for the next class, because it'll change your perspective not only on light, but on how we see the subjects and draw attention to them. It's not a pictorialism class per se, but I might do more of these pictorialism workshops if people are interested. I think the overall goal here of what I'm getting at on today's topic, and I want you guys to go to the show notes or to the Facebook group, and I'll link this week's post on the Facebook group from the show notes as well. And tell me what you think about pictorialism, all this AI stuff, the feeling. Every show I'm doing lately kind of ties together, because on the one side we have AI and fakery and this debate about what is real and what isn't, and everybody's confused. And on the other side we have photographers and how much should we edit or how little should we edit. And the pictorialists said, hey, we're going to edit as much as we want, but it's still a photo they were making. And so they would use, even though they didn't have Photoshop, they would use all these amazing techniques to make these almost magical illustrative kind of images. But what's really cool about them is you can go look at these now, and they're over 100 years old oftentimes, and you feel the emotion of them, because they weren't faked by AI. They were real people, real places, real history, real streets, or real moments that people put together to make stories. And then they photograph those in these unique ways. They process those in these unique ways. And it does start in camera, because it would, just like when you start hunting shadow, you see light differently. If you start studying and experimenting with pictorialism and you're editing, you also start looking in camera and thinking, okay, maybe I don't want to just crop into my model here. What if I show her walking through the trees as the rays of light come through? What if I drop the shutter speed to 30th of a second? Now, a lot of your shots, your hit rate will fall then. I do this all the time on the streets, where I'm like, yeah, this is kind of not feeling anything here. What can I do? Well, but I feel something, but the photos don't feel it, is a lot of times what I'll realize. And I'll say, maybe the shadow's wrong, the light's wrong. It just doesn't have the white mood. Sometimes I have to search a little, and I'll drop the shutter speed. I'll say, hey, let's put the shutter speed to 60th, right? Let's put it down to a 30th. Let's put it to a 15th. And things start, people start blurring, things start moving. And so my quality rate drops a lot in terms of, does this photo work? Does it convey the scene? If you go to a carnival and handhold at a 30th of a second, the entire world is going to change, and it's going to start conveying the movement that you see and feel and the noises you feel. But a lot of your photos are going to be blurry. Now you might say, okay, go to a carnival and put it on a tripod. I've been a huge advocate for tripods for a long time. And yes, you can absolutely do that. But are you returning in that particular case to sterility sometimes? Because a million photos have been done of the Ferris wheel spinning from a tripod where everything else is sharp. Are you understanding what I'm saying here? Like, by experimenting and challenging yourself and understanding that everything doesn't always have to be perfect, it, yes, changes the way you edit. When you think about like pictorialist edits or other techniques that you might use from past, present, and future. But it also changes the way you capture photos. And I think we should talk more about that. I think we should talk about more about, if you guys want to hear more about like low shutter speed techniques and things like that, we can certainly talk about that more. A lot of these actual techniques, the visual aspect of them, I go to the YouTube channel and I do them over there, because obviously it's visual things we're dealing with. So on the podcast here, a lot of times I talk about the concepts of what it is that we're working on. And then I'll try to go to break out some of these topics and talk about them even more on the individual 10-minute kind of videos that are on there. I think it's fascinating. I hope you guys will go out and kind of play with pictorialism and study it a little bit. And you can check out what I'm doing with it as well, and even the tools and stuff that I'm making with it. But the main thing here that I'm trying to ultimately get at and want us to push harder at is that our photos should have feeling. Do your photos have feeling? And as you start looking for the shadow, right, on, and then the feeling and the emotion, you start to find your style more, is what I'm finding. Because you're not just trying to take photos, you're trying to convey something that you feel. And I think that is really cool. Okay, I think that's enough for today's topic. You guys get the point. We're going to wrap up the show today, but I am going to give you a pick of the week. And I know this is pretty general. Normally my pick of the weeks, I can give you a direct Amazon link to or something like that. But today my pick of the week is a 50 millimeter 1.4. And it doesn't have to be a specific one. It can be that we're talking about an old vintage 1.4, 60s, 70s, 80s kind of era. And this goes perfectly with pictorialism. But really, it's going to work with everything. We spend so much money buying the latest fast lenses, like in these, and then there's these budget China options that come out, and I rarely buy those. There's so many 50 millimeter 1.4 lenses. These are fast lenses. They're usually quite sharp, actually, but they have character to them. Their bokehs have character. One of my favorites is the Minolta Rocker 50 1.4, but the Pentax vintage 50 millimeter 1.4 is also great. I have the Olympus OM, the Zuccio, right? Not the new lenses, autofocus lenses. These are all manual focus. I have the Olympus Zuccio 50 millimeter 1.4. I have probably half a dozen 50 millimeter 1.4s. Probably the one I use the most is the Olympus, the Minolta Rocker. The Canon 50 millimeter 1.4s are also very cool. The Canon FE mount is a bit annoying. But the point is, with all of these, because they were made for 35 millimeter SLRs, you can find these lenses on like eBay or something like that, and then you can get an adapter for that lens mount. So if you have the Olympus or the Minolta Rocker, for example, and I have adapters for these for all my cameras. I have so many lens adapters. But if you go buy, let's say you go to eBay right now and you buy a Minolta Rocker 50 millimeter 1.4, you can probably find one for $60 or something like that in good shape. Try to get one without fungus. And then just buy an adapter for whether it's your Fuji or your Sony or your Canon, just off Amazon or something like that. Right. And so you just search for Minolta Rocker Canon adapter, Minolta Rocker Fuji adapter. And these companies make these adapters where you can basically just bolt this lens onto the adapter and leave it there if it's the only vintage lens you use, and always have this in your bag. Yes, it's going to be manual. Yes, you're going to love it. It just feels good. You don't have to shoot the whole shoot with it. It's bright. It's wide open. 50 is a great focal length. If you're on a crop sensor, of course, you're getting like an 80 mil or so equivalent. It's great for portraits as well. If you're on a full frame, though, I have no problem shooting a portraits on a 50 in full frame, because you still have enough compression, enough bokeh, especially a 1.4, that you get these beautiful results. If you don't already have one, if you do, go to the group and tell me what you're using and share some photos from your vintage lenses, because I love vintage lenses. And I could go on about vintage lenses, but there's nothing easier to acquire in the vintage lens world than a 50. And people say, well, why do you have so many? Because everyone's a little bit different. But some of these ones I mentioned are a great place to start. My pick of the week is any classic manual focus 50 millimeter 1.4 35. You could get 1.8s and all that, and those are really cheap. But I would say go to a 1.4. We're talking about a fast lens. In its day, when you were in a 1.4, you're getting professional high-quality lenses from that era. They're almost always really nice lenses. And they feel good. They're heavy. The focus is smooth, you know, and you can find a lot of these out there, and they give beautiful results, whether you're doing pictorialism or not. I just think you're really going to like these. I hope you guys enjoyed today's show. Let me know with your feedback. You can email me profotoshow@gmail.com. You can go to the show notes over at simeffects.com, simeffects.com/podcast. And of course, over there, you can find links to things like my pictorialism actions on there. Other things I mentioned, like elegance presets, film, all that stuff is on my site, and also links to my Shadow Hackers workshop. But I'll link everything important in the show notes for today's episode. Thank you for being here on Pro Photo Show. Send me your comments and feedback and tell me what you want to hear talk about, your questions. In fact, I've started taking on kind of these simple business type questions, like how many photos should I show the client? I just did a video about this on the channel, because some of these topics fit perfectly into like 10 minutes. Go check out my How Many Photos video, because I think you will find it very useful. In fact, I will link that, making a note right now, in the show notes as well. I try to link everything I talk about in the show notes over at simefx.com/cast. I'm Gavin Syme. We'll see you next time. This has been the Pro Photography Podcast. Peace.